And tension in another industry is creating turbulent waters in the Mediterranean Sea. The European Union has closed the official bluefin tuna fishing season 2 weeks early. French, Italian, and Spanish fleets are allegedly fishing illegally. Scientists say the valuable fish is in danger of being wiped out. Those who catch tuna say what's being wiped out is their livelihood. From Marseille, France, Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Founded by Phoenician fishermen in 600 BC, Marseille is one of the world's oldest ports. For centuries, the fishing of sardines, mackerel, and tuna has been a way of life here. That is now under threat from bureaucrats in Brussels, says Mourad Kaoul, head of the largest French tuna fishing union.
We've regulated our own fisheries since the 15th century. We don't need Brussels telling us how to do it. They've broken up almost half of our fleet in the last decade. They've destroyed fishing in the North Sea. There's nothing left there. So they're setting their sights on the Mediterranean. And tuna seems to be in style. This is simply a genocide of fishermen.
High-quality bluefin tuna earns big money at Japanese sushi markets. One large fish can net up to $50,000. About two-thirds of Mediterranean tuna is exported to Japan. Since Japanese fleets depleted tuna stocks in the Pacific, bluefin now comes from the eastern Atlantic and the Mediterranean. But despite international quotas, experts say overfishing and massive illegal catches threaten the tuna's survival. Stéphane Boucher of Greenpeace says what's really needed is a total moratorium for at least 3 to 5 years.
10 years ago, tuna in the Mediterranean was a 200 kilos fish, and now when they fish 1-200 kilos, it's exceptional. We have many very small and very young tuna in the Mediterranean. It's now we have to stop fishing tuna, to wait and to let all these very juvenile tuna grow and reproduce at least once, two times or three times before they can be fished.
About 15 giant tuna boats block the port of Bouc, not far from Marseille, part of the fishermen's protest against the early end to the season. On the dock, several hundred shirtless, smoking fishermen argue about quotas under the hot Mediterranean sun. Most of these fishermen try to earn their entire annual income from the two-month tuna season. They say there's plenty of tuna, and they want the EU to compensate them for this year's loss. 28-year-old Pierre Ferrandez gives a tour of his tuna boat. He is the third generation in his family to fish bluefin tuna in the Mediterranean. These are the powerful boats the EU says are depleting tuna stocks. Each is equipped with a giant net capable of bringing in 300 tons of tuna. Ferrandez shows a control room full of special sonar equipment that helps track down and even measure the size of each fish.
On avait un hélicoptère tous les jours sur la tête.
This year, the officials came after us with helicopters and a flotilla of boats. They shut us down right at the peak of our fishing. They stole our quotas. We had 90 more tons of fish to take. We've lost everything this year.
But while the two sides bicker, environmentalists say the tuna are fast disappearing. This year's quota for the Mediterranean was 30,000 tons, but many people think the fishermen took as much as 50,000. Scientists say for bluefin tuna to survive, the limit should be 15,000 tons. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Marseille, France.
Here's a new checklist for you. Recycle, yeah. Drive a Prius, check. Love life, not so great. Some environmentalists are having a tough time finding true love. NPR's Ben Bergman sat in on a gathering of singles in Santa Monica, California that organizers dubbed a green speed dating event.
You know, it's hard enough finding singles in L.A. with dashing good looks, a witty sense of humor, and a steady job. Tonight, there is another challenge. They've also got to have a low carbon footprint. Even environmentalists have their limits, though, so everyone valet parks. This is L.A. after all. And what do these tree huggers drive?
I drive an SUV.
An SUV?
I have a Land Rover. A Range Rover.
Jeff Sabrucher is a hedge fund manager who lives in downtown L.A. He says he's been trying really hard to get rid of his gas guzzler.
Do you consider yourself green?
Well, I recycle. That's pretty much what I do, actually. I recycle, and I try to donate money to causes, green causes.
Sabrucher is one of about 16 singles here, mostly in their 30s and 40s. They have mere minutes to see if the sparks fly before organizer Vince Dell sounds his horn and daters make the choice.
If you like somebody, pick yes in the match form. If you don't like them, pick no, but not in front of their face, okay?
No awkward exchange of numbers, no stinging face-to-face rejections.
At the end of the event, sometime tonight, I'll give you your mutual matches. So if you both pick yes, you'll get an email saying so-and-so likes you.
Dell says the key to effective speed dating is to say as little as possible.
For guys, don't talk too much. The more you say it, the more ammunition women have to reject you.
You want to leave them wanting more.
Exactly. Be mysterious. That way you get a second date.
A few minutes may not seem like much, but actually Dell says in speed dating, time is the enemy.
We ask every person at these events how much time they need. Guys need about 5 seconds, women need about 10. And so 3 minutes is more than enough. But the 3 minutes will kill you, though. They might like you after the first 5 seconds, but 2 minutes later that you're gone.
Hoping to avoid that fate, Jeff Sabrucho sits down at a small table across from Felicia Williams. Their date begins like all do, with awkward small talk.
Where are you from, Felicia?
So I live in Pasadena.
Okay. There's a lot of Pasadena people here for some reason. Yeah, there's like 3 of them already so far.
Oh, I didn't know. We should have carpooled.
Luckily, the horn sounds before the Prius-driving Williams has a chance to ask Sabrucho what he drives.
Okay, nice meeting you too. What's your name again?
Jeff,
okay.
Maybe Williams will have more luck with the next guy, aerospace consultant Francois Jacquet.
I'm very green.
Jacquet is so green that he does something even better than drive a hybrid.
And you know why? I don't own a car. I ride a bicycle. I walk all the time. Whenever I absolutely need a car, make a list of things I need to do, I rent one. I feel that this is pretty green, okay?
Okay, at the end of the night, everyone turns in their match forms. Everyone except Jacquet, that is, because unfortunately, no one is green enough for him.
Let's say somebody does all their shopping at Whole Foods Network. They drive a Prius and throughout all their working incandescent lights. All those efforts are misguided, but at least they tried, you know? I didn't even see anybody like that here. I mean, we can't all drive a bicycle like I do. But I want to see people at a green speed dating event that have at least tried, done something. But hey, let's have more of these. I think they're great.
Plans are already in the works for more green speed dating, this time in Orange County, California. Ben Bergman, NPR News, Los Angeles.
President Bush is pushing Congress to lift the 27-year ban on offshore oil drilling along much of the nation's coastline, and it's an idea that appears to be gaining ground. NPR's congressional correspondent Debbie Elliott takes us to the dividing line on the Gulf Coast, where residents in Alabama and some other states have lived with offshore production for decades, and then to Florida. And its politicians have long opposed drilling, but that's starting to change.
If you look at a government map of oil and gas activity in the Gulf of Mexico, the western parts are mostly shaded in, reflecting the 4,000 platforms pumping oil and natural gas from below the ocean floor off the coasts of Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. But cross from Alabama waters into the eastern Gulf, off Florida's coast, and you won't see any rigs on the map or on the horizon. Enid Siskin of Gulf Breeze, Florida, would like to keep it that way.
We're sitting out here at the beach looking at the sand, and it's so white, it's blinding. The water is so emerald green, it's just absolutely beautiful. And this is what drives a lot of the economy in this area. And we're not willing to sacrifice our economy for what is potentially a very small amount of oil or gas in comparison to the world supply.
Siskin has been fighting coastal drilling for 16 years as a board member of the group Gulf Coast Environmental Defense. We're at Pensacola Beach, a scenic barrier island off the Florida Panhandle. Tourism not only fuels the economy here, it's the economic engine for the state. Traditionally, that has united the state's politicians to support the federal moratorium on offshore drilling. Former Republican Governor Jeb Bush long fought to protect Florida waters, and Governor Charlie Crist took a similar stance. But now that GOP presidential candidate John McCain has changed his position and called for lifting the ban, Crist has too. He says it should be up to the states, and he'd support production off Florida's coast as long as it was, quote, far enough, safe enough, and clean enough. Republican Jeff Miller is the congressman here in Northwest Florida. He says the days of shielding Florida's waters from drilling may be over.
Well, interestingly enough, Florida has always had the political ability to go in because their citizens have said, we don't want it. That is changing.
Miller opposed offshore drilling when he was first elected to Congress in 2001, but now he favors lifting the ban, as long as drilling doesn't interfere with military training exercises in the region.
I think when the public begins to change their tune, then their elected leaders need to be paying attention to that as well. The breaking point appeared to be somewhere around $4 a gallon gas. At $3, people didn't like paying it, but they seemed relatively resolved that that was a number that they could live with. At $4, and now my diesel for my pickup truck was $4.74 last weekend, and it's not going down anytime soon.
Even some Democrats in Congress, notably members of the conservative Blue Dog Coalition, are bucking their leadership and now support legislation to lift the offshore moratorium. Miller says he's been hearing from local businesses that it's time to use the resources that might lie beneath the Eastern Gulf. The Minerals Management Service estimates that to be some 3.6 billion barrels of oil. That's roughly as much oil as the U.S. consumes in 6 months. There could be more natural gas. Still, some prominent business groups don't think drilling is worth it.
We have everything to lose and nothing to gain. Nothing.
Sandy Johnston is executive director of the Pensacola Beach Chamber of Commerce.
That would be my worst nightmare. We have people coming from all over the world to see this. Why even take a chance?
We're sitting here on the front porch of your visitor information center, and we're watching the traffic come in. People have to pay for gas to drive to get here. Do you not think that at some point the trade-off is worth it when people can no longer afford to come here?
No, I don't think so. Drilling out there in that Gulf right now today is not going to change the price of gas tomorrow or next week or next month or next year. It's just going to destroy a beautiful location.
I'm taking the ferry across Mobile Bay to Dauphin Island, Alabama. And I can look around here and see the impact of the oil and gas industry. As I look out on the water toward where the bay empties into the Gulf of Mexico and then back up toward the city of Mobile, I can count 10 or 12 natural gas rigs on the water here.
Dauphin Island is south of Mobile. I've come here to meet Francis Coleman, the editorial page editor of the Mobile Press Register. As we sit at a beachfront picnic pavilion, her description of the scene isn't too different from what I heard back in Pensacola, with one exception.
We are looking out over the Gulf of Mexico, and it's a summer morning. The sand here, the beaches are gorgeous, and there are rigs off in the distance. These are natural gas rigs. These are not oil rigs. I don't hear them. At night, you can see some of the lights. But other than that, they're just kind of interesting little blips on the horizon. It's just part of this area is part of what we see when we go to the beach.
We can see about 13 of the steel structures from our vantage point. The producing wells have a long arm jutting up that looks like a construction crane with a little flame on top. Occasionally, boats travel between the platforms. Some are fishing, others are supply vessels. Coleman calls it a mixed-use image, the Gulf here being used for both commerce and recreation. Energy companies started producing natural gas off Alabama's shores in the early 1980s. Today, there are 49 producing wells, which generate more than $500 million a year in royalties and other state revenues, according to the Alabama Oil and Gas Board. The industry is such a mainstay here that the elevators at the Mobile Chamber of Commerce are decorated with pictures of offshore platforms. The chamber's Steve Russell says gas is piped to local plants on shore and readied for the market.
The natural gas then, at that point, is distributed as far north as New York and New Jersey and also to Florida.
Back on Dauphin Island, Francis Coleman says it's time for Florida and other coastal states to ante up.
Isn't it ironic to hear everybody all over the country complaining about the cost of gasoline and bemoaning the fact that, oh my gosh, demand is up, futures or speculation is up, And here we are on the Gulf Coast, and we know we're doing our part, and there they are on their coast, and they're not doing their part.
So when she hears her cross-border neighbors whining about the price of the pump, her response? Well, bless their hearts. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Orange Beach, Alabama.
Leaders of Congress spent the last few days trying to prop up confidence in the mortgage giants. Now they turn their attention back to the high price of oil. Democrats are preparing a range of proposals. Republicans are planning a field trip to one of the places where the oil is, Alaska. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
In this election year, lawmakers fear few issues are likely to be as potent as the price of a gallon of gas. Voters want Congress to do something about gas prices, according to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
I think the American people are demanding it, and we usually don't ignore the American people when they're so loud in their voices, when their voices are so apparent.
What Republicans say voters are demanding is more oil drilling offshore and in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Last Friday, President Bush stepped up pressure on Democrats to approve expanded drilling. House Republican leader John Boehner will be leading a delegation of 10 GOP lawmakers who will jet to Alaska to press the issue.
I've never been there. I want to go see just what is there. I want to talk to the local residents about how they feel about the development of this land. And I think it's a valuable trip. I think members are going to learn a lot, and it's certainly within our purview to do this.
Democrats are skeptical of what they see as a not very fuel-efficient stunt by the GOP. Democrats are pushing a number of other measures to increase energy supplies, including pressing oil companies to drill on the 68 million acres of federal lands they already hold leases on, and to drill in the 20 million acre National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska. House Democratic Caucus Chairman Rahm Emanuel suggested GOP leader Boehner take a small side trip during his visit to Alaska.
He can call Orbitz, and there's a number of other stops he can make. There's another 68 million acres he can visit. And prior to going to Alaska, he can vote for this package, which would open up the additional 20 million of acres. And he can be the first to bring the good news that we're going to actually be drilling in that area.
Democrats also want to reinstate a ban on exports of Alaskan oil and for the president to release some of the oil stored in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, or SPRO, arguing such steps would have an immediate impact on prices. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the president's call for more drilling is a ploy.
It's a hoax. It's a subterfuge. It's a decoy to cut your attention away from the fact that their policies have produced $4 a gallon gasoline. We're saying take that price down right now, Mr. President. Release the oil from the SPRO.
But Republicans oppose that idea. GOP Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee says the strategic reserve is needed for times of crisis.
We would greatly jeopardize our country's national security by lowering the amount that is there. And I think people recognize that. I think most calls to do that are just populist kinds of ideas to try to make the American people think that we're doing something that is of benefit when what we're really doing is harming ourselves.
While the two parties seem as usual to be talking past each other, some Democrats have been taking a second look at expanded offshore drilling. Senate Democratic leaders appear open to the idea of legislation allowing more drilling paired with additional conservation measures, but at this point their counterparts in the House seem unlikely to go along. Brian Naylor, NPR News, The Capitol.
You most likely have heard that coral reefs around the world are in bad shape these days, and new research says the situation is getting worse. As much as a third of the world's coral species now may be headed toward extinction. Coral reef experts have been meeting all week in Florida to draw attention to this threat, and NPR's John Nielsen has more on what they're saying.
Coral reefs, like rainforests, hold an amazing range of plants and animals. In fact, according to biologist Philip Mundy, these reefs hold a quarter of the species found in the world's oceans.
It's quite stunning when you get in the water
on a lovely, clear day and you drop down onto a reef and there are just fish everywhere, hundreds of thousands of fish, sort of things you almost don't see anywhere else.
Mundy's with James Cook University in Australia. He says reefs like these used to be commonplace in shallow waters all over the tropics. In addition to the fish, they featured sponges, lobsters, turtles, urchins, shrimp, anemones, you name it. Unfortunately, reefs like these are now few and far between. Kent Carpenter is a reef expert at Old Dominion University in Virginia. Recently, he reviewed the status of 850 different coral species. What he found was that a third of them may be headed toward extinction. Fishing boats have ruined some of the reefs, while others have been killed by diseases. Carpenter says reefs that don't die quickly are sometimes finished off by nasty-looking gobs of algae.
I've been on several coral reefs recently that have had large clumps of algae growing on the corals themselves. And if you pull off the algae, you see that the corals underneath them have died.
Carpenter says that's a sight as ugly as the image of a thriving reef is beautiful.
It's heart-wrenching, and I guess I can't emphasize enough that this is a whole ecosystem that we could be potentially losing on the planet.
That's the message in a so-called coral red list that's been published by Carpenter in the journal Science. Basically, it names the threats to the world's coral species. Researchers prepared it after poring through records kept by field biologists stationed all over the tropics. The red list researchers found evidence that hints that coral diseases hit more frequently in waters warmed by man-made climate changes. And Carpenter says even bigger threats to coral species could emerge if emissions of global warming gases are not reduced soon. For example, as the oceans soak up more carbon dioxide, they're becoming more acidic, says Carpenter. And while there is some evidence that coral reefs can find ways to adapt to rising temperatures,
there's no evidence at all that they can adapt to different pH or acidic regimes. Obviously, the overarching problem that has to be solved is the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
2,700 coral reef experts met all week in Florida to talk about these problems. On Monday, scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration issued a report that seemed to echo some of Carpenter's findings. It concluded that a quarter of the reefs found in American waters were in poor condition. But reef scientists like Philip Mundy say there are a few rays of hope here. For example, the new coral red list seems to show that some Pacific reefs are finding ways to thrive in warmer waters. And when fishermen were banned from all but ruined reefs in Australian waters, big fish seemed to show up out of nowhere.
And that's just in a few years. And so it gives us enormous hope that these populations of fish can rebound if they're given the chance to do so.
At the least, he says, these changes could give the reefs a little more time. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.